a large number of children who were amputated inside hospitals because of the kind of bombs used by the Israeli military. Now, telling these stories is important. The world needs to understand that a singular event that lasted for how long? Three hours, was followed by 23 months of brutality that have destroyed everything across the Gaza Strip. And this is not a call that what happened was okay. We're not saying this. But we're saying what we're looking at for 23 months, this aggression continues to unfold in the most barbaric way. I've seen bombs falling nonstop on 10th site in Al-Mawasi, an area that's supposed to be safe for people. I've seen it targeting the schools while people are sheltering inside. I've seen it targeting marketplace while at rush hour where they are overcrowded with people trying to buy food. So we've seen death in all forms and all shapes here across the strip. And standing here at this moment, is it safe? No, it's not safe at all. I mean, there's no guarantee that anything could happen here. Any bad thing could happen, whether you are here in the street, in an office, inside your home. Because again, this is very consistent with what the Israeli officials made it clear from the opening weeks of this genocide. They said there is no one safe here. Dehumanization, the demonization of Palestinians. And it looks like they put journalists at the top of the list and they to track them one by one. And if not them, it's their families. We've seen journalists' families, whole entire families been wiped off the civil registry simply because they were telling the truth. They were documenting what was going on the ground. This is Israel's tactics to suppress any voice of a criticism on the ground, to maintain that vision worldwide that they are fighting barbarians, they're fighting terror, they're fighting uncivilized population. But guess what? This has changed. And I hope it will continue to change, because what we're seeing on a daily basis, what you see on the screen, is only a tiny bit of what we're able to show you. On the ground, it's even worse. I have nights that I never slept at all, just visualizing everything that we cover throughout these days. The scenes of the children soaked in blood inside hospitals, or the collapsing fathers, the crying mothers over the bodies of her whole entire family. The malnourished, the emaciated bodies of the children inside the hospital. All these are haunting us throughout the night. And it's not the only thing that keeps us awake. The drones in the background that keeps buzzing and grinding down on the mental and the psychological well-being of everyone here keeps us awake throughout the night. Alert, because we are hyper-vigil right now, because we don't know when the next attack is going to happen.
Hani, as we wrap up, what gives you the courage to keep reporting, to staying there in Gaza, with so many of your colleagues killed, hundreds of them, and also your thoughts on Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, not allowing in international journalists, as hundreds of your colleagues, Palestinian colleagues in Gaza, are killed?
And I don't see him allowing any international journalists coming to Gaza. I know about a month ago, in a press conference, he gathered some 20 journalists who waited for him to finish. No one had the courage to ask any of the serious questions, to question the credibility of the information, to question the policies, the acts on the ground here. He basically dominated the CNN, pushed for the narrative that we have been hearing for the past 23 months over what's going on. What we're seeing is a genocide by all means. I mean, anyone with tiny knowledge of what's going on would understand that what's going on here on the ground is a genocide. When you systematically destroy the whole entire society, you either look at one thing, emptying the land, or by ways of population thinning or population transfer. That includes, of course, the mass killing of everyone. But the moment we see international journalists coming in here, things will change. I just hope at this point now, wherever they are, they would raise their voices. They will demand It's their right to be in this area. I mean, forget about the fact that the Israeli military is worried about their safety. What about the safety of everyone here, the safety of the civilian population here? The other day, I was listening to an Israeli reservist who was making some math about the number of people killed here. And to my surprise, it was more than what the health ministry here estimated. We're talking about close to 60,000 Palestinians have been killed. And this is how his math played out. He said for every Hamas member, there were two civilians. And he added, he continued to say, like 30,000 Hamas members were killed, plus the, I mean, if you double that, that's 60,000 Palestinians killed. And that's by their own math. It's more than what we have been able to count here and document, apart from those who are under the rubble who are counted by the thousand. Literally by the thousand. At the opening weeks of the war, the Israeli military carpet bombed the entire northern part of the strip. I remember this area vividly with its high-rise buildings. Many of the residential buildings and towers in that area completely wiped out. During the January ceasefire, we covered extensively from northern part of the strip, and I walked for hours just looking for one standing building, and I could not find a single one. All flattened completely, and we were told by surviving family members many were still buried under the rubble. So until we see more of this on the screen, I think things will continue to get worse. And it doesn't matter how many meetings are running at the Security Council or the United Nations or elsewhere, without any meaningful, practical steps on the ground, we are on our way to annihilation, basically. If not from the bombs, it's from the lack of food, the lack of basic supplies, the lack of water. It's a harsh reality, but it is what it is.
Hani Mahmoud, Al Jazeera correspondent based in Gaza, speaking to us just outside Gaza City. Thank you so much, and be safe. Coming up, investigative reporter Ken Klippenstein on Trump's war on the left following the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk and this week's deadly shooting at an immigration jail in Dallas that killed one migrant, leaving two critically injured. Stay with us. By the late legendary pianist and composer Randy Weston. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's escalating his attack on progressives following the assassination of the conservative activist Charlie Kirk and a deadly shooting that targeted an immigration jail and an ICE van in Dallas, Texas. On Thursday, President Trump signed a national security memo authorizing government-wide investigations into nonprofits, activists, and their donors. The memo calls for the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, quote, to coordinate a, quote, national strategy to investigate, prosecute, and disrupt entities and individuals engaged in political violence, unquote. Since the assassination of Charlie Kirk, September 10th, President Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and other White House officials have repeatedly blamed Democrats and progressive groups for the attack, even though no evidence has emerged linking the accused shooter, Tyler Robinson, as well as the person involved in the ICE shootings with any progressive organizations. On Thursday, federal authorities said they also have not uncovered evidence linking the man who attacked that ICE facility to outside groups. Wednesday's shooting in Dallas left one ICE detainee dead and two migrants critically injured. Authorities say the suspected gunman, Joshua Young, who died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, was attempting to target ICE agents, not detainees. This is FBI agent Joseph Rothbach speaking at a news conference yesterday.
Young specifically intended to kill ICE agents. He fired at transport vehicles carrying ICE personnel, federal agents, and detainees. He also fired multiple shots into the windows of the office building where numerous ICE employees do their jobs every day. We now know that Jan engaged in significant high degree of pre-attack planning. He searched for information about the office building and how to track ICE agents' locations. Jan also acknowledged the potential for other casualties.
On Thursday, President Trump reiterated his threat against what he called the radical left.
Radical left is causing this problem, not the right, the radical left. And it's going to get worse, and ultimately it's going to go back on them. I mean, bad things happen when they play these games. And I'll give you a little clue. The right is a lot tougher than the left, but the right's not doing this. They're not doing it, and they better not get them energized because it won't be good for the left.
We go right now to Madison, Wisconsin, where we're joined by investigative journalist Ken Klippenstein, who's been reporting on the shooting of Charlie Kirk and the attack on the ICE jail in Dallas. His most recent article, The ICE Shooter's Politics, Joshua Young's Friends Speak. Ken, welcome back to Democracy Now! Tell us what you found out.
Hi, Amy. Good to be back. Well, I tracked down three friends of the deceased shooter who had known him since childhood, and asked them straightforwardly, what were his politics? What were his views? And their answer was basically that he had libertarian leanings, but he was generally apolitical. And that was something that was corroborated by his own brother, who gave an interview saying, this guy wasn't political. I'd never heard him say anything about ICE prior to this. And one of the most surprising aspects of this investigation for me was talking to his former friends, and I kept running into the same issue, which was that I'd fallen out of touch with him and didn't have recent insight into what his views were. I kept hearing this, and by the third time I hear it, the person says, you know what happened? Probably no one knew him recently other than maybe his immediate family, because he started spending huge amounts of time on the anonymous chat forum called 4chan and just playing video games. So apparently he dropped out of school, kind of became a recluse, lost all social contact. Immersed himself in this world of, just to describe 4chan, provocation and trolling and, people would describe it as sort of controversial site. And then there ends up being the shooting, and I ask his friends about it. He has written on, these unused bullets, anti-ICE. Clearly it's anti-ICE, right? And his friends say, I wouldn't interpret it that way. He was never a sincere guy. Everything he said was laced with irony and sarcasm. He was a very sardonic person, so they were all skeptical of the idea that this was anything but some practical joke. They said that, because of his libertarian leanings, he didn't like the government, and that apparently, according to investigators, was one of the conclusions they came to based on what they've been able to go over that he left behind. But that wasn't specific to the right or the left. That was a general disdain for government and a disdain that he seemed to have for all sorts of things in life.
And Kash Patel, the FBI director, tweeting out this picture of one of his bullets saying anti-ICE. And also this misinterpretation, it sounds like you're saying, when they say he's anti-federal government, that it's this particular government, or is it just all government?
Yeah, as his friends described to me, it was all government. He was someone who was contemptuous, I would say, of authority in general. I was sent videos of his comedy going back to middle school, and what came across in them was he was always being tongue-in-cheek and making fun of things, which, isn't a problem in itself. But as was described to me, once he started spending all this time on 4chan and gaming, and I want to stress, there are lots of gamers. In his case, though, we're talking over 10,000 hours on just three video games, all shooter games. according to his Steam profile, which is like a gaming platform. And, you know, as was described to me, that became his entire community, these chat rooms and the people that he talked to in these video games. And it sounded like he started getting more and more extreme views. His friends stopped talking to him because they couldn't stomach, you know, his shock humor and how over the top things were getting. And that's the last insight they have. And then we see what happens. And sadly, people didn't seem, they were surprised, but I don't know that they were shocked. Based on my conversations with his former friends. But yeah, it's a very complicated case to go through, because within just minutes of the investigators getting that photo of the unspent shell casings that had anti-ice written, FBI Director Kash Patel posted that to social media, which is very unusual. In FBI protocol, they tend to not want to release things because they don't want to harm an ongoing investigation. You know, tip off the people that they're investigating, or in this case, imperil conclusions that the investigators might come to. And of course, social media took that and ran with it and said, right up to President Trump in a statement to Truth Social, saying, you know, this is the radical left. Clearly, look, anti-ICE. That must be the left. And I talked to his friends, and they said, well, that doesn't sound like how the left talks. They say things like abolish ICE, or you know, maybe more fiery language than that. But yeah, there was a lot of skepticism about this very straightforward interpretation of what happened.
So do you see similarities between these terminally online nihilistic politics of both Jan and also Tyler Robinson, how he was characterized, the man who assassinated the conservative activist Charlie Kirk?
Yes, definitely. At first, I thought, you know, gaming has become, to young people, it's sort of like the NFL is for lots of folks, including myself. I'm someone that's played video games in the past plenty, you know, so I don't want to stigmatize it. That being said, the way in which these guys talk is very specific to the subcultural spaces in which they lived. In the case of Tyler Robinson, on Discord, which, you know, in the major press, I think there's confusion about what Discord is. It's basically just WhatsApp for video games. You can make phone calls, video calls, texts, and things. I had sent to me, based on several of these chat rooms that he was in, messages from Robinson, and it was basically the same picture. Not somebody who was overtly political. There was literally one post mentioning Trump and one post mentioning Biden. And in the case of Biden, it was about I think both were about the 2020 election. So, of course, everyone's paying attention to politics at that time. But it was a very different picture than what you would have gotten, certainly from the Trump administration, which took this and ran with it immediately, saying that this is evidence of the out-of-control, violent assassination culture of the left. But also in major press. I mean, I don't blame people for thinking, okay, well, this must have been political. But when I talk to folks, both in the case of Tyler Robinson in Utah and in Texas, you quickly get the impression that they both, perhaps like most of the country, despises both political parties to the extent that they had views on politics at all. And I think that picture gets lost when the major media, overwhelmingly based in Washington, you know, I lived there for several years, and the sense is, you know, there's two teams and everybody wants to know which team you are. People generally affiliated with one or the other. That's not how most Americans see politics. And that was perhaps the most normal thing about these two shooters, that they were disengaged with politics.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ken Klippenstein. We want to have you back on soon. There's so much that you're reporting, and we'll link to your pieces, most recently, The ICE Shooter's Politics. Coming up, we speak to the Deputy Foreign Minister of Cuba as Latin American leaders condemn a new U.S. bombing campaign in the Caribbean, mainly aimed at Venezuela. Back in 20 seconds.
Una canción de amor esta noche. Es lo que yo te quiero entregar. Para que solo tú la retoces. Para romperla luego de amar.
I give you a song by Sylvia Rodriguez performing at Central Park Summer Stage in 2017.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. At the United Nations General Assembly, a number of Latin American leaders condemned the U.S. for unilaterally attacking boats in the Caribbean. The Pentagon recently sent warships to the region after Trump secretly authorized the use of military force in Latin America under the guise of the war on drugs. The bombing campaign began earlier this month when the U.S. blew up a boat carrying 11 people off the coast of Venezuela. President Trump claimed the boat was carrying drugs from Venezuela, but offered no proof of the claim. A number of experts believe, looking at the video, that the boat passengers may have been migrants. This is Colombian President Gustavo Petro addressing the United Nations.
The young people killed by missiles in the Caribbean did not belong to the Trendaragua gang. Perhaps nobody here even knows their names, nor to Hamas. They're from the Caribbean, possibly Colombians. And if they were Colombians, with apologies to those who dominate the United Nations, criminal proceedings should be opened against those U.S. officials responsible, including the top official who gave the order, President Trump.
Cuba's Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez also condemned the U.S. strikes in the Caribbean.
The interception and destruction of boats, the extrajudicial killing of civilians, the interception of fishing vessels and aggressive actions by the United States and the Eastern Caribbean create a dangerous situation that threatens regional peace and security. I reiterate Cuba's unconditional solidarity with President Nicolas Maduro Moros, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, and the civil military union of its people.
For more, we're joined by Carlos Fernandez de Cosío, Cuba's deputy foreign minister, here in our New York studio. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can start off by responding to the U.S. bombing these boats, most often linked to Venezuela, and boarding a fisherman's boat, what you think is U.S. plans and what is Cuba's response?
Well, thank you for having me. We believe that the whole military presence in the Southern Caribbean, extraordinary and extravagant in our opinion, is a threat to Venezuela and to the countries of the region. There's no real reason for that to be there, and the justification that they're fighting drugs or organized crime is believed by no one. The attack on the boat, an extrajudicial attack, it's unacceptable on international, based on international law, and we guess that U.S. domestic law. They're assassinating people for no reason, without evidence, and without showing what's the reason why they will try to attack these people.
So how are Latin American leaders organizing at this point?
The region has, the majority of the governments in the region have expressed their concern. There are instances of concerting ideas in the region through CELAC, through ALBA, but there's not today a full consensus on how to deal with this issue.
You may have heard that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has summoned hundreds of generals and admirals to a base in Northern Virginia next week for an unprecedented meeting of the nation's military. Do you have any idea what that is about?
We have seen that the politicians and the public in general in the United States is questioning what's the reason for this, and we're following it. Truly, we don't see a reason. It could be of a domestic nature, or it could be the attempt of doing something outside of the United States.
The strikes appear to have been outside of any declared war zone, targeting civilians who pose no immediate threat. Legal experts say such extrajudicial killings violate both U.S. and international law. Very interestingly, there are Republicans as well as Democrats who have condemned what President Trump is doing. We just heard Gustavo Petro. He has called for criminal proceedings against the Trump administration over the military strikes in Venezuela. You are a close ally of Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro has attempted diplomacy. The White House said it has dismissed an office from Maduro to engage in direct talks with President Trump aimed at de-escalating the U.S.-Venezuela relationship. What do you think has to happen now?
I believe there has to be a responsible attitude from the United States. In the case of Cuba, any aggression or any threat of aggression to any Latin American or Caribbean nation will, of course, will imply that we have full solidarity with a nation under threat or under aggression. We believe that the international community should send a clear message, not only Latin America and the Caribbean, to the U.S., that violating international law, carrying out aggressions and threats of aggression, goes against the U.N. Charter and against the principles with which the international community should live.
I want to ask you about another issue that came up this week. President Trump held a news conference at the White House promoting the unproven claims that the common painkiller Tylenol causes autism in children if taken during pregnancy. So why would I be asking you about this? You're not a doctor and you're not from the United States. But during his comments, President Trump brought up Cuba.
There are parts of the world that don't take Tylenol. I mean, there's a rumor, and I don't know if it's so or not, that Cuba, they don't have Tylenol because they don't have the money for Tylenol, and they have virtually no autism, okay? Tell me about that one.
And they virtually have no autism. This is one of the first things that I've heard President Trump say about Cuba that is not negative. Is this true, though?
First, I'm not surprised. Americans in general, politicians included, are frequently ill-informed or misinformed about Cuba because there's a lot of propaganda regarding Cuba that distorts reality. In Cuba, first of all, we produce acetaminophen, and acetaminophen is prescribed to the population as a respected painkiller. And in Cuba, we have autism. In fact, we have a very strong program of autism that covers the whole country. Because of the nature of our public health system, we have the exact number. It's not estimated. We have the exact number of people who suffer autism. We have special schools, special programs, special clinics, special programs that go down to the community. It's quite well treated. And we have even cooperation with other countries around the world regarding the issues of autism.
And of course, I'm not saying that a person on the spectrum, that is negative. But President Trump, his comments, I think, surprised many, especially in Cuba, where you have autism clinics, where you have people working on this issue. Finally, when President Trump took office, he reinstated Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. Is that going to change?
We hope so. The only link of Cuba with terrorism is as a victim of terrorism carried out by the United States for years, sponsored by the government of the United States. Today, where it's allowed, there are people living in the United States that finance, organize, and carry out violent and terrorist actions against Cuba. That exists today. We're not saying that today the government is participating, but the government is tolerant with those people.
Many people have been concerned that President Trump is so concerned about the Epstein files, and I'm sure you've read about that, his relationship with this sex offender, that he will do anything to distract attention, and that these bombings of the boats are a way to prod Venezuela and perhaps even Cuba, a close ally of Venezuela, to attack back, which would then, of course, divert all attention to what's happening in Latin America and the U.S. relationship. Your response?
It could be the case. It wouldn't be the first time in the history of the United States when something like this occurs. And we do understand, as I said at the beginning, that the current military presence in the Southern Caribbean is totally unjustified. It's extravagant and it's extraordinary, and it's threatening to the peoples of the region.
I want to thank you for being with us. Carlos Fernandez de Cossío is Cuba's deputy foreign minister. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah-Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nizal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Karl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick. This is Democracy Now! I'll be traveling through the country. Check our website at democracynow.org. Thank you.
Hi there. This is Jan Arden. And if you're listening to Something Fabulous, Well, you're listening to DJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Every day, PFLAG Canada volunteers are contacted by frightened kids and by angry, fearful, or ashamed parents. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.